Welcome to Issues and Ideas. Coming up on today's program, travel correspondent Tom Wilmer takes us to the north side of Omaha, Nebraska, a hub of American jazz and blues since the 1920s. Tom visits Love's Jazz and Art Center. But up first, local author Gary Williams has a new book that recounts his adventures as a horse and dog trainer and a contract cowboy. Marisa Waddell talks with him about the lessons he's learned along the way.
I'm Marisa Waddell with you on Issues and Ideas. My guest today is a cowboy. Gary L. Williams wanted to be a cowboy from the very beginning, like many other boys, but for him it was more than a fantasy. He has been riding since he was little. He trained his first horse at age 12, and he's been a contract cowboy, a horse trainer, and a dog trainer for most of his life. Gary now has a book that recounts his adventures. It's called Lessons from the Range, and it was just published by the Graphic Communications Institute at Cal Poly. Gary Williams, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Marisa.
Well, it's a pleasure having you. And this is your first book. It feels to me like a series of short stories about becoming a cowboy and then working as a cowboy. And I suspect you're a natural storyteller. You have lots of stories to tell. And I'm wondering, is that why you decided to write the book?
Not really. Writing a book was never on my priority list. I'd rather be out in the middle of nowhere on a horse than sitting in front of a desk writing a book. But nagging from my wife, and what was really interesting was I had a client that I was driving down south with, and she happened to mention, "Boy, you need to write a book." And I said, "Yeah, my wife's been telling me that for years," but that was all that was said. A week later, here come a package in the mail from this lady that contained a really nice voice recorder and a note, "I want your first book." So I sat that recorder on the dashboard of my pickup, and while I had windshield time, I get to thinking about different stories and adventures that I had during my life, and I'd put it on this recorder. And that's how it all began. And as I got more into it, I thought, you know what? If nobody ever bought a single book, at least I'd have some history for my grandchildren and great-grandchildren so they'd know pretty much what I'd done in my life.
Mm-hmm. And so you wrote it down. Hooked up with the Cal Poly Graphic Communication Institute, which was fortuitous.
Absolutely.
And so now you have this book full of stories of your adventures. And one thing that impresses me about Lessons from the Range is that it's full of lessons. And not just about being a good cowboy, but about being a good human being. It, kind of like, learning to respect other human beings and learning to hang in there even when the going gets tough. What are some of the most valuable lessons that you felt you've learned in your becoming and being a cowboy?
Well, as growing up, my dad instilled a lot of that into me. I can remember lots of times as children, we had responsibilities on the ranch. We had to do our chores, and my dad was a strong man, and we were expected to do our chores before we ate. And many, many times I'd be sitting at the dinner table and my dad would say, "Have you done your chores?" If I said no, I was up going to do my chores and eating a cold dinner. If I lied, I was really in trouble. So it instilled in me a work ethic that you start a job and you finish a job. You have responsibilities and you should go forward and respect those responsibilities and get them done.
Mm-hmm. You've also written about learning lessons from the horses themselves. What are some of the valuable lessons you learned from a horse?
Well, you know, I've been training horses for over 50 years, and all horses are different, just like all people are different. I mean, there's similarities to the training methods, but as a horse trainer, you have to be a horseman, not just a cowboy on a horse. In other words, you've got to understand what makes that horse tick, what makes that horse think, and be able to work with each individual horse in order to accomplish what your task is. And I've learned many, many things from different horses and patience. Patience is the biggest thing that you, as a horse trainer, have to have.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell, and my guest is cowboy and now author Gary Williams, who's written a book, Lessons from the Range, Adventures of a Working Cowboy. You grew up on a ranch in western Washington, and your first horse was from Roy Rogers Ranch. Can you tell me a little bit about your relationship with Roy Rogers?
Well, my dad and he were really close friends and hunting partners. They did a lot of goose hunting together, and Roy had a bunch of hound dogs, and they run hounds together, and they just had a lot of fun. Growing up with him, we'd go to visit his place, and of course he had to show me every horse he had, you know, because I was such a horse enthusiast from a young age. And so he and I had quite a rapport with the horses. An interesting story that we had as I was growing up, Roy came to our place. He was going to the World's Fair. You know, he was supposed to fly into SeaTac Airport where all the media was waiting for him to arrive. Instead, he pulls into my dad's driveway, pulling a boat, a big motorhome, and he spent 2 or 3 days with us, and then my dad drove him to Tacoma, where he got on a plane, flew to Seattle, and got off for the media. Well, while he was there, he had a few days off, so Dad booked a fishing trip at Westport. He had told the skipper there to try and keep this quiet. You know, he didn't want Roy to have to go through a lot of rigmarole and people having to sign autographs and all that. So we got on the boat at 4 o'clock that morning. Went out, fished, had a great time. Roy caught a couple big old king salmon, and everybody on the boat caught fish. And when we got through at the end of the day, we came back to the dock, and we literally couldn't get off. It had gotten out that Roy was on the boat. The crowd was so immense that we finally had to get the police to come in and get us off the boat.
That must have been impressive for you as a kid, you know, seeing all of this media attention. And
it was quite different for me, mm-hmm. you know, and it made a very... very much of an impression on me, because I did not want to have Roy's life because of that, you know, so I've been more comfortable in my life being on a horse someplace away from people. And so this, with the book, is kind of out of my comfort zone, but I'm getting through it.
So your first horse, Pal, was from Roy Rogers, but he ended up being too much horse for you, as you put it. What made him too much horse?
Well, I was only 6 years old, and this horse was 16 hands, and he was a little bit of an older horse, and he had a lot of spirit to him, and I just wasn't able to handle him at that age. And so my dad took him on and made a ranch horse out of him, even though my dad had taught him several tricks and made kind of a show horse out of him also.
So you write about one of your dad's horses, Roni, who ended up being a racehorse rather than a ranch horse. What makes a horse good at different things, and what in particular makes a good cowboy's horse?
Well, some horses are bred differently. You know, you've got several different breeds, the thoroughbreds and the quarter horses and Appaloosas. All the horses are bred for a specific reason. And the horse that my dad had was an appendix horse. He was half quarter horse and half thoroughbred. Even though my dad was using him quite a bit on the ranch, he had a tremendous amount of speed. And as the story in the book continues about Roni having a reputation of having some speed, my cousin had borrowed him to use him as a pickup horse at several rodeos. Well, my dad was unaware that my cousin was also racing the horse because he did have some speed. Mm-hmm. And he and I just happened to be out gathering cattle one day, and this car pulled up alongside highway watching us, and we really didn't pay a whole lot of attention because that was something that we were kind of used to, because people would see us out working and they want to stop and take pictures and enjoy, you know, what we were doing. And so we didn't pay much attention to him until he started waving at us. And we went over there to see what his problem was. We figured he might be broke down along the road. And that's when we discovered this man had seen my dad's horse racing. Noticed the NY brand on his left shoulder and says, "Hey, that horse had been racing." My dad goes, "No, this horse had never run a race in his life." Well, come to find out, yes, he had been racing him and winning and beating some of the fastest horses around the area in the stake races. So that's how we got Roni into racing. But and as it turned out, because of the racing part of his thoroughbred blood being very hot-blooded, he got to the point where all he wanted to do is run at that point. And so he didn't make a real good ranch horse after that.
So what makes a good ranch horse?
Horses that are bred to work cattle, that have what we call a cow. You know, horses that have cow in them. Horses that you don't have to continually direct what to do and how to do it. You know, because these horses are bred to work, if you show them how to do it a few times, they start figuring out the easiest way to do things and working a cow on their own. And that's what makes a good cow horse.
Oh, that's really interesting. So they can figure some things out by themselves without being directed.
Oh, yes, because of the breeding behind them.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell, and my guest is Gary Williams. He's a cowboy, he's an author, a dog and horse trainer, and his new book is called Lessons from the Range, Adventures of a Working Cowboy. One thing that struck me about your book is how dangerous it can be to do the work of a cowboy, from being thrown to being knocked in the head by an oak branch. Will you please read a section in your book? It's the one Digging Out from the Ditch, and that's pages 58 and 59.
One day I was riding Red out through one of the irrigated pastures to check on the bulls. As we'd done thousands of times before, we came to one of the 3-feet-wide ditches. Red jumped the ditch, only to have his hind feet slip off the bank, which broke off, and when he jumped, his hind feet slid into the water and the mud. His front feet were on the bank on the other side. As he leapt to gain his footing, he lost his balance and fell over backwards into the ditch, pinning me underneath him and under the water, leaving him stuck upside down in the narrow ditch. The ditch was wide enough to hold him there, but not wide enough to let him roll over and get up. I was struggling to keep my head above the water. I would grab a breath of air every time my head would come up. I knew I was in trouble as he thrashed around on top of me trying to get his feet. It seemed like I was under him for a long time, but in reality, I suppose only 5 or 10 minutes. But that was long enough for me to start wondering if I was going to survive. Finally, as my horse struggled to get right side up, I got an opportunity to get out from under him. I climbed out of the ditch and quickly grabbed the bridle reins to help him get his balance before he drowned. After a little more thrashing around with me guiding his head, Red was able to turn over and get to his feet and jump out of the ditch. I was really thankful. I praised God for saving me and Red again. We were saved, but on our workload, we just have to keep going. Soaking wet, Red and I continued to do our daily duties. It was just another day on a ranch. You have to just keep moving forward.
Huh, just keep moving forward. That's pretty scary, being underwater with a horse on top of you upside down. And that's just one of those kinds of stories that we see in your book. What makes you want to continue being a cowboy all this time, being knocked in the head by oak branches and being knocked off your horse?
Well, as my dad always said, you know how you make a cowboy? You pull his hat down over his eyes and beat his brains out. Then you have a cowboy. So you just keep going. You know, you don't think anything about it. It's an adrenaline rush for me. I love it. The more dangerous, the better I like it.
So it's just part of the job.
Part of the job.
Do you have any book signings or events coming up that we should know about?
Actually, I don't write at the moment. I've done, this makes my third radio interview, and I've had 2 different book signings, which did very, very well, and I feel very humbled about it. And but nothing coming up right away. I do have books available at both Farm Supplies in San Luis Obispo and in Paso Robles, at Templeton Feed in Templeton. And you can get my book from my website, cowboydogtrainer.com, Lessons from the Range, and PayPal comes up.
Well, thank you so much, Gary L. Williams.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure having you. Gary is the author of Lessons from the Range, Adventures of a Working Cowboy, and you can learn more about it at cowboydogtrainer.com. For Issues and Ideas, I'm Marisa Waddell.
And you're listening to Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX. Still to come on today's program, travel correspondent Tom Wilmer visits Love's Jazz and Art Center in Omaha, Nebraska. Coming up today at 1:30, it's a special broadcast of Ideasphere with Guy Rathbun. He talks with Carla Kaplan, whose book is the first to examine the story surrounding a number of white women who challenged the system by crossing race lines viewed as impenetrable. That's 1:30 today here on Public Radio KCBX.
When I first arrived in Omaha, Nebraska, I quickly discovered a place that offers an amazing diversity of things to do and see, ranging from music, theater, trend-setting culinary experiences, to a palpable history, as well as icons of America, such as the legendary Boys Town, founded by Father Flanagan nearly a century ago. I'm Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me in Omaha for a journey of discovery. We'll start out at Love's Jazz and Arts Center in the heart of the north side of town. Love's is a nonprofit center that melds the best of local and regional art and music. Tim Clark, Executive Director of Love's Jazz and Art Center. How cool. Tell us about it and the history.
Yes. Hey, thank you very much, and welcome to what we call the good life here in Omaha, Nebraska. And if your listeners could see, I'm doing the jazz hand as our official welcome to you. I'm the Executive Director of the Love Jazz and Art Center, and our primary focus is to preserve, present, and promote African-American arts and jazz, and specifically around the late and the great Preston Love. He was a noted big band jazz band leader.
From an Omaha native, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's from Omaha, Nebraska. And you know, when you think about Omaha, believe it or not, Omaha was once known as a national jazz hub. And you would think, well, Omaha, what's in Omaha? You know, steers and cattle and whatever. No, we geographically.
You're talking an equal with Kansas City.
Absolutely, equal with Kansas City, because we were in the middle. So if you were coming from the East Coast, West Coast, so a lot of this was a natural stop for a lot of national artists, and they stopped right here in Omaha.
In the 20s and 30s.
Who, 40s, 50s. I mean, it really
went right on through.
It was a long span of time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as they say, this joint is hopping. I mean, this area was really vibrant, live. You had, you know, six or seven jazz clubs and in the area.
Some of the names of the legendary performers who would have made stops here.
Oh, you had from Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, Count Basie, the Duke, you name them, they came through here on their way to somewhere else. And then Omaha became known for picking up great sidemen or musicians as well. And so it was really a kind of a nice hidden jewel that people just didn't know about in terms of significance of what Omaha did for his contribution to music. Another great name that came out of Omaha was Buddy Miles, late Buddy Miles, which he was the drummer for Jimi Hendrix.
And he's from Omaha.
And a lot of folks in the California area may know him from the California Raisin commercial. He was the talent behind the California Raisin. So, yeah, so there's Omaha mostly known for, you know, the famous or the billionaire Warren Buffett, for a lot of noted names in terms of sports, but also music was a very very strong in terms of creating a strong name for Omaha for some great musicians coming out of Omaha.
Would it be fair to ask, is there or was there an Omaha sound?
You know what? I think it was. Yeah, I think there. And we're trying to really redefine that now as you look at, also what really took away a lot of that energy was a lot of the race riots and things that was happening in the 60s. So it pretty much destroyed all the things I'm talking about, man. It really destroyed all that. Mm-hmm. And so the Love Jazz and Arts Center is really providing the leadership, the catalyst to reigniting that renaissance that took place back in the day.
Let's go back to the day. Let's say 1939, 1940. It would begin be fair to assume that the segregation and racism that you encountered in Kansas City would be similar here, right?
Absolutely.
Total basic segregation. You think about the paradox, though. Is that what created that incubator, that beautiful, pristine catalyst that you would not have had if it hadn't been the ugly days?
That's right. Absolutely.
Isn't that a paradox?
It really is. And music, the sharing of music and culture, it brought people together. But yet, even when you think about an area that was probably predominantly populated by people of color, but people traveled from all parts of the city to come to North Omaha, and particularly because of unbelievable arts and entertainment. And so that's what we're trying to get back to, so we can become that destination, that attraction that will allow people from both from Omaha, from Nebraska, and surrounding
the
areas.
The whole region.
And the whole region.
So is it working? Is this going through a renaissance? Is it becoming a hub once again?
I think it's working. I think it's working. And sometimes they say, hey, you know, it's one day at a time. But I think it's working. I think we're doing what it takes to reignite that excitement and attract the kind of people we need to attract to bring it back. And so, you know, it took a long time to create that. So it's going to take a while to get it back to where we want. But I think we have a window of opportunity that I really think in the next 3 years, when you come back to Omaha, you're going to see a whole transformation of culture, arts, and entertainment that's happening right in North Omaha.
I love it. Let's dig a little deeper on Love's Jazz and Arts Center. Where did the vision come from? When was it born?
In 2005. Under the leadership of a former city council person, Frank Brown, really was his vision, along with Neville, Mary, and some other folks, that said, hey, what's our way back to re-synergizing, re-energizing this whole cultural base in North Omaha? And so they put together a board in partnership with the city, and they formed a partnership that allowed for them to attract some dollars to renovate this building. Basically put together two buildings. This was right across the street, an old Safeway building. This was some office space and, you know, everything in terms of the past. But that's what ignited and got it started, was really a former city official. And now we're really looking at doing other things.
When did it open?
In 2005.
Since then, you have had ongoing live performers.
Yes, right.
Is it primarily trying to showcase local and regional performers, or do you try and bring in national acts?
Yeah, we've had national performers, and we've had international exhibits. So there's two focal points. We do national and local exhibits.
This is both art.
That's right.
Exhibit you're talking about.
Yeah, that takes care of the art component. And then we do the live jazz and the preservation of the legacy of jazz and Preston Love. And so we've had exhibits from the United Nations here, national traveling exhibits. And so there is just unbelievable opportunities to see world-class art here. We featured a gentleman out of Atlanta by the name of Cecil Bernard. He's noted as the artist for the stars. This here, what you see, is called Songs from the Soul. And this is about 40 pieces of work that's really is a static portraits of unbelievable artists. I mean, you can see the likes of Ray Charles and Aretha Franklin, Marvin Gaye, and B.B. King, and seeing what they contributed to the world as it relates to music. So we try to keep that, but then we promote and highlight local artists. This is becoming the venue and the spot. If you want to experience some authentic or some straightforward jazz or some contemporary or smooth jazz, this is the place. We have some of the best players in the city, in the area, that comes here and play on a consistent basis. And then we also look at regional. We bring in artists from Kansas City and the region, and national artists. We've had national artists come in as well.
Example of a national
artist. National artist, Mike Phillips. He's a world-renowned jazz saxophonist that's been here. We've had several other artists that's come here in terms of just national artists, but it's been, you know, under my leadership for the last 3 years. And so it's kind of gone through management change, kind of a retooling.
Is the mission, is it a nonprofit mission?
Yeah.
What's the ultimate intent?
Well, we're 501c3, so we really focus on not only just educational programs, we work with trying to keep alive the mission of preserving, promoting, presenting African-American art and jazz.
What's your mission in reaching out to the young kids, junior high, high school? Because it seems that's your future.
That's right. And we do understand that, in that, especially when you think about jazz. Jazz is one of the original American art forms that was created right here in the United States, in America.
As much right here in the Midwest as New York.
Absolutely. Yeah. But if we don't do the kind of things to keep it in the front of our young people, we lose it. And so we do work with our school districts and group workshops, interactive workshops.
So you go to the schools too?
Actually, we...
Or they come
they
here?
They come here. Okay. Primarily the students come here. And not only students, but also senior citizens, adults. And we have interactive type programs that really allow for us to keep that alive in terms of educating, increasing the awareness and educating people about jazz as American art form.
That's so awesome. So this really is the showcase venue for Omaha.
Yes, absolutely. This is the premier showcase venue for live music and art, particularly jazz and African-American art. Absolutely. I think as your listeners are looking at, especially you're traveling to the Midwest, I think this is a must. You know, stop and check out our website at lovesjazzandartcenter.org. Or they can call us and say, hey, what's going on at Love Jazz and Arts Center? We call it short for LJAC. You know, it's kind of, you know, live, you know, jazz at the LJAC.
Love it.
And so they can call us at 402-502-5291. And just if they're going to be in the area and want to come and experience the Omaha vibe of jazz, smooth, because we do have our own little sound that we do here that's very unique to the Midwest.
What's a typical cover?
$5-$10.
Oh, that's brutal.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and, you know, it is. And so, but the thing is, being a 501c3, we keep it low.
Yes.
And so we can make it affordable for the area because we're anchored in the community. And so sometimes you see outfits like ours, they outprice themselves, and the community can't even take advantage of it.
Yeah, or the only people that are left are the elitist people, and the common man is cut out of their own music.
Absolutely. And so we really try to pay attention to making sure it's affordable for the community.
I love it.
Yeah. You know, I thank you for this opportunity, man, and we keep your eyes and ears on the Love Jazz and Arts Center because we're on the move, and we are absolutely jazzed about our future.
I love it. Tim Clark, Executive Director at Love's Jazz and Arts Center in the heart of Omaha, Nebraska. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
My pleasure.
And that does it for today's Issues and Ideas here on KCBX. Support for KCBX is provided by UCSB Arts and Lectures, presenting Trombone Shorty and Orleans Avenue with their blend of funk, jazz rock, and R&B at UCSB's Campbell Hall, Thursday evening, January 23rd at 8 p.m. Tickets are available at 893-3535. Time now to check the KCBX community calendar. Two members of the group The Scarlet Furies, still Steve Hillstein and Steve Ambrarian, have formed their own group, Stereo Steve. They will be appearing at Bon Tom's Creole Cafe next Monday night. For all the details, check out the community calendar at kcbx.org. This is KCBX HD1 San Luis Obispo, KNBX HD1 San Ardo, and KSBX Santa Barbara. Stay tuned next for a special broadcast of Ideasphere with Guy Rathbun.
It's Ideasphere with Carla Kaplan. Her book, Miss N in Harlem.
One of the reasons I became interested in these women is not because they're perfect, not because they're role models, not because I think they got everything right, but because as individuals, they tried to take responsibility for that history of racism. And that's remarkable in and of itself.
This is the story about the upper-class white women of the 1920s who chose to identify with Black Harlem. It's told by Carla Kaplan in her new book, Miss N in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices with Professor Carla Kaplan. Her previous works include The Erotics of Talk and Zora Neale Hurston, A Life in Letters. This is the first book to tell the story of a number of spirited white women who crossed racial lines. They played seminal roles in the great black cultural movement of the early 20th century that became known as the Harlem Renaissance. Professor Kaplan is on the line with me. Hello, thanks for joining the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
The overriding racial prejudice of the 1920s and 30s is the focus for our discussion, especially when it came to the upper-class white women who chose to oppose the caste system. But it's also about the backlash from both blacks and whites.
That's one of the things that made the choice these women made so difficult, was that for lots of important strategic, political, historical reasons, there were very mixed feelings, as you know, throughout the black community about mixed couples. Not so much from an ethical perspective inside the black community, but from a sense of drawing the wrong kind of publicity, not advancing the cause. Really, it's just a history rife with tension in each direction.
One of the stories that is woven through your work is known as the Scottsboro case. Although we'll have a chance to talk about this in more detail later, I'd like to set the context. It's important. In 1931, nine young black men were accused of raping two known prostitutes, Ruby Bates and Victoria Price. Although there was no evidence supporting the claim and there were no witnesses, the men were sentenced to die, even though Miss Bates later recanted her testimony. However, she kept her racist outlook, occasionally referring to blacks as lower and less valuable than whites. And then it goes on to say she did not want to go down in history as a nigger lover.
Yes. And I think it's really hard for us in some ways to wrap our minds around the force of that phrase. Now, one of the reasons it's hard for us to wrap our minds around the force of that phrase is we have trained ourselves rightly not to use the N-word.
Yes.
So it's not a phrase we think about. But that phrase in its day was a phrase that carried with it the absolute fact that your life would change from then on and that in essence you could never go home again. What that phrase meant was that the community into which you had been born would no longer accept you. You were in all, for all intents and purposes, you had become an exile from the community into which you had been born. Now, for some people, right, for the people who sort of made their life's motto, I don't care, that may have been just fine. But even the people who make their life's motto, I don't care, nobody likes to be thrown out of the party. Everybody likes to leave on their own volition, right? Mm. And the sense of being sort of, you know, it's sort of like being hurled out of a moving car at 35 miles an hour. It was an enormously forceful phrase, and it was a very serious social threat. It really carried the threat of physical violence. There were so many instances in which the vitriol expressed towards whites who crossed race lines was in some ways even stronger because of the surprise factor than the vitriol towards blacks on the part of white racists. So it was an enormous, powerful threat.
We also have another situation here that you delve into in your book, and that is the racism on both sides. The blacks not just in Harlem but elsewhere, looked down upon the white women who would enter their circle.
Yes. I'm not sure we want to call it racism on both sides.
Okay.
But we certainly want to call it antagonism on both sides. I am very uncomfortable myself with the notion that there can be any kind of symmetry between white attitudes at this historical moment towards race and black attitudes at this historical moment towards race, even if we're talking about the same phenomenon, even if we're talking about interracial marriage, because it's the histories are so different that what whites are responding to and what blacks are responding to, the differential in social power, the differential in a history of violence and threat, it's just altogether different, which is to say that when the black community responded with a lot of antagonism towards white women who made those choices, it was a very different kind of gesture, right, that stemmed from a need to keep the community as safe as possible under truly unsafe conditions. Mm-hmm. So it is a remarkable thing. Part of what made the conversation, I think, so difficult then and makes the conversation so difficult now is that it's really been difficult to talk for 100 years, 200, 300 years, to have an open and an honest conversation about the weight of black rage and the weight of black anger, which is a different kind of thing than white fear. They're both very powerful, right? But they're different. They come from being on very different sides of this history. I don't know if what I'm saying is making sense, but but these complicated layers came into play for the women I write about in ways that almost proved paralyzing. And I think what I find so remarkable is that these women weren't paralyzed, that they just kept trying to move forward. Not always cleverly, but they kept trying.
Yes. in very different ways. You have one who is so outgoing and wants to be known. She writes, although anonymously, in a couple of cases, about her blackness of being a white woman. On the other hand, you have another who chooses to almost remain anonymous. She doesn't want her name mentioned.
Yes.
So it's interesting to have these as bookends.
Yes. In fact, I would say in a way there are two who really chose a form of anonymity. Charlotte Mason, absolutely, with her rules and, as she called them with a capital L, her laws of never speaking her name and absolute silence about who she was. But Lillian Wood, who passively passed as black, who allowed people for decades to believe she was black, was also engaging in a quiet form of self-erasure, was also very much involved in creating a life in which she wouldn't have to be very visible, where she could live the way she wanted to. And the choices that she was making, geographical, racial, from a perspective of gender, were all choices that were not considered very acceptable or likely for her. And so the less attention she drew to herself from her perspective, the better. And so for some of these women, there was an enormous freedom in not being seen, while on the other hand, you have someone like Nancy Cunard who cannot step away from the camera. She can't do it, even when she should, right?
Advisable, yes.
Yes. Even, well, you know, you sort of are standing in the sidelines wanting to say, sit down, Nancy, sit down, right? And she can't do it. Part of what fascinated me was exactly as you talk about, that range of responses. All of these women were looking to find a way to live outside the script that was available to them as women. And all of these strategies were part of that, were part of trying to buy themselves a little extra freedom, a little extra room to make choices. In all cases, they were strategically trying to sort of edge out a new life for themselves.
And then you have another completely different. She's the godmother, in fact, supportive of writers and artists in the black community.
Yes, Charlotte Mason.
Yeah.
What a character.
Yeah.
Very, very complicated person. And her relationship to notions of publicity was enormously complicated by her absolute desire to control everything around her. And that meant everything that was said about her or not said, how she was seen. And she used her money in a way that other people might use a panoply of other kinds of strategies to negotiate their way in the world. And she relied on her money to sort of build herself a superhighway. It was interesting to me to watch, in a sense, her doing that over many years, because it's not something, for the most part, we have associated with the way women make a place for themselves in the world. And she was just absolutely throwing her weight around in a way we don't think of women doing at that time.
This is all very interesting. I think what perhaps a reader is going to find piquing their interest, as it did mine, is what led you to this? What I'm asking that is, it was almost a taboo subject just a couple of generations ago. We didn't talk about it. It happened, but it happened to other people. And it certainly wasn't something that happened to someone who was completely comfortable in who they were or sane in their actions. Yeah. And so now you find a very good reason to work the structure of what brought about these actions of these women. And it wasn't just a rebellion against their color.
No, it was so much more complicated, and there were so many layers and pieces to it. And you're exactly right. It wasn't just a reaction against their color. It would be an altogether different story if we could make it that clean. But in every case, they had their own reasons for doing what they were doing, and it was a mix of motives, as it always is.
Yes, of course.
I don't think anybody steps outside the lines unless they have a real mix of motives. Nobody does. If you're going to really take chances, there has to be something, as you perceive it, in it for you.
Mm-hmm.
Part of what I was trying to get at was, what was in it for them? Partly because often it was a very unhappy process. And so I wanted to sort of unravel, what were they after and what was in it for them? But, I mean, you're absolutely right. This was not a topic, certainly the history of women doing this, that had received a lot of attention. And in a sense, I came to it, I don't want to say by mistake, because that's not quite right, but it was honestly one of those books that I wanted to read. I spent a lot of years when I was working on Zora Neale Hurston's letters looking for a book like this, and finally realized that if I was going to read this book, I would have to write it. But I was trying to find out information about the white women of Harlem, because Hurston was very close to many of these women. That's one of the reasons she threads them together throughout the book. And as I was working on her letters and trying to explain those relationships, I was stunned at the absence of material on these white women who were Hurston's friends.
Yes.
And that's what eventually led me to this project, because there just was nothing out there.
Ms. Kaplan, you have a website or tweet or anything else you'd recommend for listeners to contact you or read more?
Very easy to remember. It's just www.carlakaplan.com. One of the features I've included on the website is a link to a form that people can fill out if they have Miss Anne stories of their own that they would like to see shared on this site. I'm quite certain that one of the things this book will do, at least I hope so, is to flush out similar stories of people who were these complicated mixed motive racial pioneers. And I fully expect to be contacted, at least I hope I will be, by somebody who says, my Aunt Gladys was one of these women. She was a Ziegfeld Follies dancer, or she was this. And I'd like to provide a space where more of these stories can be told. I do think it's time for us to be able to deal with the full complexity of some of these lives, because I think it's time we have to deal with the full complexity of our own historical moment. And I hope to flush out more of these stories and provide a place for them.
Talking with Carla Kaplan, author of the book Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance. This is Ideasphere. We'll be right back.
And this is KCBX. Coming up at 2 o'clock, it's On Being. Krista Tippett speaks with Reverend Lucas Johnson and Dr. Gwendolyn Zohara Simmons about deromanticizing the civil rights movement and rediscovering its models and lessons for social change in our time. That's On Being at 2 o'clock today here on Public Radio KCBX.
Welcome back to Ideasphere with Professor Carla Kaplan, her book, Miss Anne in Harlem. Something that makes your work so valuable in that it's a story that has been closeted for so long, making it not only very difficult to flesh out the stories of these women, but also to understand them because it was, as said before, a point of embarrassment for maybe even the family.
Well, that was certainly an obstacle to me for a time in my work, and I just have to say that the families of those who are in this book, who fully supported what I was doing and helped me and provided material and turned over diaries and let me go through the steamer trunks and gave me the photographs, were very brave because it wasn't always the case that every single family member was behind bringing these stories to light. Part of the difficulty of telling some of these stories is the embarrassment within families over old stories of ostracism or exile or not accepting these women's new families in some cases. So I'm enormously grateful for the family support I did get, and I did get quite a bit. Not from everybody. There were women's stories I might have told if I had been able to get support from the families.
Let's turn to the migration of blacks to the north, this happening in the teens and early 20s, and they land in Harlem. At the time, Harlem has just emerged from mostly a Dutch community, and eventually the blacks did dominate the area and what became known as the Harlem Renaissance. One of the things we think of is those of us who are just passively looking at Harlem Renaissance, we think of that time as being a mecca for blacks, a time where they could be heard in voice, in art, and in song. However, as Langston Hughes points out, and I'm so glad you brought this into the picture here, the Harlem Vogue wasn't that glamorous for blacks.
That's right. In fact, Claude McKay has a really amazing angry piece about how, you know, everything in Harlem is owned by non-blacks.
Yes.
It was one of the incredible complications of this historical moment, because let's pick up on that word you used. It's exactly right, the sense that Harlem was a mecca. People did talk about making pilgrimages to Harlem. Blacks talked about making pilgrimages to America's black city, right? That's how it was seen as a mecca because of the possibilities of self-definition. After decades of being negatively portrayed from the outside, the confluence of the Great Migration and the cultural explosion that the Great Migration allowed and encouraged created new conditions for self-expression and for self-definition that were fundamental to why it was considered a mecca and fundamental to the sense that this was a spiritual and a political and a cultural as well as a geographical home. But at no time was Harlem an all-black city, and at no time was that cultural explosion an all-black cultural explosion. It was always an interracial place. And much of the funding, as we've known for a long time, for some of that cultural explosion came from interracial groups. And a great deal of the political work that was undergirding the cultural explosion and vice versa came from interracial political organizations. This caused a lot of confusion and it caused a lot of difficulty because, you know, there were many people who felt great about that interracial energy, and many people who resented fiercely that interracial energy, and frequently those were the same people. Which is to say, at one moment, on Langston Hughes might be going out to dinner and staying up nearly all night long with his best friend, white Carl Van Vechten, and turning around and 20 minutes later and writing a satirical piece about the ridiculousness of whites in Harlem. So this was being lived from the inside as a contradiction and as a difficulty, but also as something that was generative. I don't think it was just a negative. I don't think this contradiction between the Mecca for blacks and the white-infused Harlem Vogue, I don't think that was just negative. I think that it was such a complicated thing, it produced a kind of vibrancy and a kind of energy.
And that energy was seen in the art and the music that was coming about. And turning that back around to the blacks in the community, the men, the blacks, were unable to get gainful employment in many ways because of the shops in Harlem owned by various people, the Jews, the Italians, et cetera, et cetera. So the blacks were in an awkward position there. And then the black women had to deal with, what are these white women doing among us?
Yes.
They're stealing our men.
Yes. They're stealing our men, and they're posing a danger to all of us in the community.
Yeah.
Because for hundreds of years, what white women had symbolized in the black community was often the threat of death. Given the long, long history of using a myth of black rapists, of white women, as a form of racial terrorization, as an excuse for racial terror and violence perpetrated against black men, white women had come to symbolize for many people in black communities a threat or a danger. So it's much worse than here they are, just they're stealing our men, right?
Right.
And they're threatening our safety.
Yes.
And they're making all of us unsafe. So this is just an enormously complicated set of things all coming together at once, because even as people are feeling that, many, the most active members of Harlem, also aspired towards and longed for a truly interracial America. So on the one hand, the presence of these white women in Harlem looks like a really deadly threat to some people. To some others, it just looks ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it also looks like the manifestation of a vision seen as something way, way in the future. So all of these things are roiling around at the same time.
You said something that is almost a key to your book, because it threads throughout in influencing the thinking of the day and how monumental it was. We only know it now as the Scottsboro case.
Yes.
This is the black raping a white woman, which turned out not to be the case with the recantation of one of the women. However, that case had a very large impact on black and white society in the 1930s.
An impact that, again, it's almost hard for us to understand, because this is an historical moment that precedes the explosion later of television and, of course, now of the Internet. So the cases that become national cases aren't competing with 100 other national cases. The cases that become national cases, like the Scottsboro case, or a number of years prior to that, the Sacco and Vanzetti case, or the Lindbergh kidnapping, are truly national cases, which is to say, really, everybody's looking at the same thing. And the Scottsboro case absolutely riveted the nation. And it was a kind of a Rorschach test for race relations and for the possibility of positive racial change in the country. And it was a pretty dismal Rorschach test, particularly, as you mentioned, Ruby Bates's recantation. For people who were hoping that when the truth came out in the Scottsboro case, it would dispel this horrible, hideous myth of the black rapist, to find out that even when Ruby Bates said it never happened, that no one believed her. What that told people was that the weight of the lie was so much heavier than the weight of the truth. It was a very despairing moment for progressives in the country after Ruby Bates recanted and her recantation made little difference.
Yes.
It was a real feeling of despair. Here she finally gets out in front of the public and in her sort of odd way says, this never happened. I made this up. I was afraid of getting in trouble. There was no rape. And yet all the trials of the Scottsboro boys proceed as if she had never said that, as if she had never said it didn't happen. In other words, that the sort of the power of the lie that this is what black men do couldn't even be interrupted by the truth.
And how much of that, too, is the whites of that era inability to face their own inner selves and how they have abused the system?
I couldn't agree more, and to face also the depth of their stereotypes of black men, to face the extent to which they so believed that black men were dangerous that even in the face of a shocking revelation of how wrong they had things, they couldn't revise their view.
Yeah.
They couldn't undo that notion. I think it's the weight of that history that made the George Zimmerman case so poignant and profound for people, because once again, we have everything turning on someone's sense that a young black man is dangerous, someone's feeling about that. And these are feelings with a history. These are feelings that with a history that go back hundreds of years that, exactly as you say, have been very difficult for white culture writ large to take responsibility for. One of the reasons I became interested in these women is not because they're perfect, not because they're role models, not because I think they got everything right, but because as individuals, they tried to take responsibility for that history of racism. And that's remarkable in and of itself.
It is.
To try to do that. Because we all live inside these systems, and one of the reasons we don't take responsibility is we don't have to. It's really not on us personally, right? It's happening out there. We don't know how to fix it, and we don't know how to intervene in it, and we're just one person. It's not our fault, and we didn't do it, and we don't know how to change it. But these women said, no, it's on me. I have to do something about this. And again, I'm not saying what they did was perfect, but the gesture of saying, this is on me, I'm going to take responsibility, I find that really quite remarkable.
Well, that's what makes your book that much better, and the fact that we as readers are able to get inside a story that's not been addressed to this date, and I'm very happy it has.
Well, I can't thank you enough for that, and you clearly get it, and that's lovely to hear.
Thank you so much for taking this time. It's been a real pleasure. We've hardly touched the book, but that's good, because we want readers to be lured into it.
Well, thank you so much for your time and for your interest. I'm quite grateful.
Check out Ms. Kaplan's work at CarlaKaplan.com. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.